Hello, and welcome to the MIT Press podcast. In this week's episode, best-selling author and games historian John Peterson will be speaking to Peter Biebergau about Dungeons & Dragons, fantasy fiction, and his new book, Appendix N. Peter Biebergau is a writer based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the author of multiple books, including Strange Frequencies, Season of the Witch, and Too Much to Dream. In February, Strange Attractor published his most recent book, Appendix N. Taking its name from the list of inspirational reading provided in the first edition of Dungeons & Dragons, his book brings together short stories and other fragments of writing that generated and continue to populate the literary context of Dungeons & Dragons. Speaking with Peter is John Peterson, who is a leading expert on Dungeons & Dragons and role-playing games generally, and the author of many books, including Playing at the World, Dungeons & Dragons Art and Arcana, and the New York Times bestseller Heroes Feast. He's also the author of The Elusive Shift and the forthcoming Game Wizards, both published by the MIT Press. With all that said, I'll now hand over to John and Peter.
Welcome to the MIT Press podcast. My name is John Peterson, and I'm here today with Peter Biebergau, who is the author of a book I was really psyched to hear about when I learned that it was about to be released. It is called Appendix N, The Eldritch Roots of Dungeons and Dragons. So Peter, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, no, thank you. I'm a fan of your work, and it's really great to meet you and to be talking to you about, I think, something that we both love very much.
We do both love this very much. And, you know, this, we need to be careful not to be too inside baseball.
I think that's right.
I mean, I think it's probably important just from the get-go. Can you tell us a bit about Appendix N, what it is, what it tells us, and why it's so interesting to people like you and I?
Sure. So Appendix N is an appendix from the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons Dungeon Master's Guide that was released in 1979. Interestingly, it was not the first book in the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons line to be released. We can talk about that. And it is a section which Gary Gygax, who is essentially the named author of the Dungeon Master's Guide, and he calls it the inspirational and educational reading section of this Dungeon Master's Guide. And he proposes in this appendix, which is really not even, doesn't even take up a whole page in the book, is his attempt to show new players or just people who have been familiar with the game the kinds of literary influences on him growing up and just what he loves in terms of as being a reader and how they helped him in some ways. This is where it gets tricky, but I think in some ways how it helped shaped the look and feel of Dungeons & Dragons. What's interesting about Appendix N, though, is I think it's not a good place to find out where he got ideas for rules or for sort of the population, like monsters and characters or classes within the world. There's a little bit of that in there, and it'll be fun with you to try to tease out what some of those are. But I like to think of it essentially as really just a window into the mind of Gary Gygax, of the books and stories that he loved. And as a game designer who was going to be, who was designing a game that was essentially a fantasy role-playing game, how those kind of was sort of like the DNA of his thinking about what fantasy was and how to make worlds. So I think there's a lot of world building too, which is something that's an important part of what he gleaned, I think, from some of these texts.
Definitely. And yeah, I mean, when we look at D&D, you know, there may be people who are listening to this that aren't super familiar with the kinds of stories you end up in D&D.
Right.
So maybe that would be kind of an interesting place for us to start on exploring like what the scope of that influence might have been. What do you see as kind of the life or arc of the typical dungeon adventure? What do you do when you play D&D? If you're a player, yep. You take on a character. That character yep. is going to be in a heroic fantasy context. and is going to have some adventures. But like, what kind of, what's your perspective? Because this is an interesting curated list of stories you provided in this book, and we'll delve into that in some detail. Kind of, what's your perspective on what is the kind of stories you end up telling with D&D?
Well, I think one thing that's interesting, though, is especially for people who are playing now, who were first introduced to D&D via the more current editions, like what's now called 5e, the fifth edition of D&D, I think in some ways, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, is a little bit different of the game that Guy Gax describes in the Dungeon Master's Guide in 1979. And I think it's partly because I think that the Dungeon Master's Guide in 1979 is describing a little bit more of a fantasy sandbox, whereas I think the Dungeons and Dragons of the fifth edition, which is what most or many people really, especially those new to the game, are playing today, seems a little less sandboxy insofar as Dungeons and Dragons feels like a universe of places and people and gods and things. So what's interesting about the D&D of the Dungeon Master's Guide in Appendix N, and that it's a little bit more, it feels a little bit more sandbox, is that it is, I think, a little bit more, owns a little bit more to those pulp influences that is what drove Gygax in many ways, and that we see in Appendix N. So in many ways, and this then is true for all D&D really though, but the core is you are some, like you said, some form of heroic adventurer who is trying to, there's always the quest. I mean, this goes back, right, to some very classic even fantasy tropes. You're given a quest, a puzzle to solve, someone to rescue, a monster to stop, a treasure to find, and you're placed sort of in a location where you then have to succeed or not, right, in uncovering or completing the quest. And I think what's interesting is that in many ways, it was very oriented towards the idea that these adventures were, for the most part, likely to take place in some kind of dungeon or underground or lost temple or some structure, right? There were certainly what were called wilderness campaigns. But I think that when you look at D&D and you see that influence, that there really does seem to be this idea that the gameplay is much more, is very local, if that makes sense, in terms of like a place.
Yeah, definitely that does make a lot of sense. And I mean, it might help as well to talk a little bit about modules, or the ways that the earliest ways that D&D tried to integrate explicit stories into the game, where there is a prepackaged, sold product that contains a dungeon or an adventure, might be wilderness or underworld or whatever. And that, that the players find their characters kind of thrust into a very specific quest. Yep. And, that led to this whole new kind of authorship dimension, potentially, to the game, as opposed to the more freeform. If you look at the very, very earliest version of the rules, you see you're being instructed to devise your own dungeon, right? Devise your own world, your own situations. And then this kind of transitioned eventually into a more authorial thing. And I think, to your point, a lot of the 5e players today, I mean, there's this thing we call the Adventures League. There's like a set of modules that are major releases that come out of Wizards of the Coast that, people play kind of, it's almost like tournament seasons, right? Everyone gets a new adventure to play and people play through them. And so certainly that has gone to a point where often prescribing a story arc, if you're successful, if you make it through the dungeon, if you're not all killed by a bugbear or whatever, has become a much more significant part of it than it was in the initial vision of the game.
Yes. And I think that the initial vision of the game also, which is very fascinating to me, was built into the rule book, especially the Dungeon Master's Guide, is a fully functioning set of guidelines and charts for playing completely improv. And so you could play it just like that without you could quickly devise an overarching backstory and why you're there. But it's very interesting. You don't need that broader authorship of a world or a campaign or multiple tiers of sort of conspiracies, right, to get the characters to just be in doing what was and is sometimes still called a dungeon crawl.
Yeah, and obviously that was the roots of so many procedurally generated dungeon games that have come since, the roguelikes, you know, down to some of the ways Diablo and things like that work. And so certainly an idea that had like really long legs.
Yes, right.
But I mean, the interesting thing about looking at D&D through the lens of the fantasy fiction that inspired it is, you know, the relationship between those fictions, the kind of stories you might experience, right, when you go into D&D. And as you point out in the intro to the book, you know, there were a couple of versions of this that came out. There was kind of Guy Gax's original Appendix N, citing his influences in 79. And certainly, if you go back, you can find places in Dragon Magazine
even earlier. Very short little lists.
Yeah, yeah, we had these smaller lists of kind of these are the things
that will impact. Even mentions Piers Anthony.
Piers Anthony. Right, yeah. I read some of those Xanth books when I was a
kid. Oh, I love those.
I remember them. Yep. But, you know, and then there was the Moldvay version, right, that came out the BX basic set in 1981. And you draw on both, actually, or at least you examine both in this.
Yes, and I examine, and it's interesting, what I try to do is I didn't want to dive too deep into that list, except to find what I maybe, and I'm sure that some folks who read this book will be critical of, I made some executive decisions about things that I knew Guy Gax must have been aware of, and for whatever reason didn't include in Appendix N, but felt that they are still so, they still feel so much a part of that zeitgeist that it was hard to not want to at least let readers know. These are some other tales that were considered essential pulp fantasy stories. Very likely Guy Gax was aware of them. Why they're not in here, I don't know, but they are in this other Appendix N, or, you know, version of it. So I thought it was fair to draw from that. I do think what's interesting about the later guide to, you know, fantasy fiction for its influence on D&D was that it was more about stories that looked like D&D games as opposed to proto D&D stories. And that's why you start to see a lot of contemporary fiction to that time, especially by that point where we already start to see in the late 70s and 80s this real explosion of quest-based fantasy fiction, somewhat inspired by D&D, but probably more inspired by the resurgence of popularity in Tolkien that was happening in the 60s and 70s, especially with like the Hobbit animated show, the Lord of the Ring films. And then you start to have those series like Sword of Shannara and, you know, the Piers Anthony and this sort of epic fantasy fiction doorstop trilogy type things, I think, was much more contemporary to the D&D of 1981 than, believe it or not, I think even to the D&D of 79. I think in those years, there's really an incredible upsurge in the fiction world and even in pop culture in general, don't you think, in films especially?
No, I remember you remarking in the introduction that, you know, you always thought of wizards like Gandalf in the Rankin-Bass adaptation, right?
That's
like
right, that,
that's
exactly.
Visualized when you thought of a wizard. And I'm sure that's true of a lot of us who were growing up around that time.
Yes.
But it is, as you say, it's your own Appendix N. And I think you make that clear that this is,
yes,
these are the things that, and I found actually, obviously many of the stories in there I'd read before, but I reread them when I got an advanced copy of the book. And I was really astonished by the thematic unity across them. I mean, I think as a curated selection, there are a lot of things that these stories really tend to have in common. So many of the stories are of the wandering adventurer who shows up at this town, right? And this town has a problem, and this problem needs to be, it's almost like a Western or something like that. So can you talk a bit about, because I felt like a conscious curation decision to me,
yes,
to kind of show that is the primary focus of this. Talk a bit about that selection and why you found that kind of the most fertile to examine.
Sure. Well, I think it was partly a matter of some of the restrictions that I found that I had to place on the book. So for example, as I started to go through, you know, there's the idea, let's put together this appendix. Sounds great. Okay. But now what is that really going to look like when you start to look at what is actually in Guy Gax's list? First of all, a great number of them are novels. And I didn't want to excerpt novels It's just not interesting for readers. It doesn't feel like it just feels like it's a little bit too of a sampler of something rather than of a nice collection that you could sit and maybe not know anything or care anything about D&D and still enjoy these stories, right? So I wanted to avoid that. There were also some things that I couldn't get the rights for whatever reason, right? That limits you in many ways. And then what I also found was that there were authors that Guy Gax named, and he would name works of theirs that I felt were not quite as, well, one thing is I wanted to see when he only mentioned the novels, I wanted to see if I could find instead short stories by those same authors that seemed to capture the spirit of the novels that he loved, right? Because again, I didn't want to excerpt. So it was a really amazing experience to sort of really sift through all that. And I really want to give a shout out to the Internet Fiction Database. Yes, okay. Thank you. The Internet Speculative Fiction Database. This is like what the web is supposed to be for. I mean, this is old school. You can look up an author. You can look up then link to any of their stories. It will list every place that story has appeared, and it will have the cover art for every place in which that story appeared, or for the book in if it's a novel. So sometimes what I would do is I would just troll through author lists of short stories. And then again, luckily, thanks to something like archive.org, be able to then find those stories in their own electronic archive of all these pulp magazines to be able to read them, get a sense if they felt like they were right. And so given all those limitations, I realized, you know, and in the end, this really is going to be my appendix N. This is my appendix N of Guy Gax's appendix N. And so what does that feel like for me? Well, what does D&D feel like to me? D&D feels a little bit more like Conan, say, than it does, believe it or not, Tolkien, right? So I felt like I wanted to find something that felt a little pulpier, a little weirder, a little more like what the 70s felt like in terms of the pop culture. And so I hope that what my appendix N is my appendix N of is a weirder version of Guy Gax's appendix N. One that is really looking for the necromantic magics and the strange, you know, there's even a story where the protagonist has to go through a portal into another dimension to meet with some almost Lovecraft-like demonic creature so that she can save her kingdom. You know, there's a C.L. Moore story. So I was sort of, again, trying to find things that felt that the heroes or the protagonists were under threat of terrible injury or death. Right. And when that wasn't the case, that what they were encountering was almost Lovecraftian in its eldritch, to use that word again, feel.
And definitely, I mean, anyone who knows your previous work, and I'm a great admirer of your Season of the Witch, knows how much you've tapped into that 70s zeitgeist you were just describing, you know, in your descriptions of Zeppelin and Bowie and things like that in that book. And so I think. It's the kind of collection I would have expected you to curate.
Oh, good.
Which is
that does make it.
I mean that in a good way.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, and I think everybody has their own appendix to N, and I think it's important to recognize that we all have those texts that I think as gamers in particular, as people who play role playing games, especially those of us who maybe our DMs who want to create worlds, we're absolutely influenced in many ways by the movies we've seen, the books that we've read, the comics, all of that, and drawing from all of those things, I think shows how what Guy Gax did was almost kind of give all D&D players permission to sort of curate their own stories for their own experience with D&D. But at the same time, I hope, despite how, yes, personal it is in that way, that it still honors Guy Gax's original list, that I don't veer, you know, 90% of the stuff in there is from his list. maybe not the stories are exactly to those he mentioned, but at least to the authors. And so it's not so far out that it's still not in the end, I hope, a good look at the stuff that influenced Gygax.
No, definitely. I think it is. And, you know, I mean, I think we all acknowledge as well that sometimes Gygax isn't as straightforward as he should be about some right. of his influences. You alluded to Tolkien as we went through that. And obviously, I mean, anybody thinking about the origins of D&D, Tolkien's a big part of it. Like, kind of what's your take on Gygax's love-hate? Would that be the way to put it? Relationship with Tolkien? And
yeah,
you know, that's
really something.
Yeah, there's one aspect of that as well that I think is very salient to this discussion and to the stories you curated. You know, I mean, a lot of these heroic fantasy stories are about single adventurers who show up, which is, as we know, usually not how you play D&D.
That's
usually
right.
You're in a group, and a lot of people attribute that group structure to the Fellowship of the Ring, to the,
that's right.
you know, the Company of Dwarves, right, that
right.
Bilbo Baggins was attached to. You know, and you do have a few stories in there of which the one that I think hits closest to the mark in terms of Gygax influences is certainly Two-Sword Adventure. I guess you used the Jewel in the Forest title.
That's
for
right.
That.
That's yeah. right. Yes.
Which is not a story about a solo adventure. It's a story about Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser, right? Coming
that's
together.
Right. Yes.
And, you know, they have their own dynamic, and that dynamic may be very familiar, I think, to D&D
yes.
players.
It feels the most D&D like story.
Probably. Yeah.
yeah.
And it's an old one, right? That
yes,
really goes
old.
Back.
Yep,
it's
the 30s, yeah.
Yep. But you also, I noticed, you curated a number of other stories that also kind of have a group to them. Like there's the story about Marcus and Diana and their trip to the town of vampires. There's
that's
the story.
Right, yes.
Even the Conan story, Tower of the Elephants, a very famous Conan story, you know, is not one where he is acting solo, where he actually enlists a Confederate in the middle of his
that's
mission.
That's right. Yes.
They at least briefly work together.
I know exactly.
The ignominious death. Of
yes. Her. And I love the friend he meets there. I mean, it's such a great, but it is, it's the kind of those pragmatic friendships that you assume your party has to maintain when you're playing D&D so that you can sort of get along well enough to work together, right? Even though you may not agree 100% with somebody else's, maybe the paladin is too stuck up for you or whatever.
Right,
it is, right.
right.
But I also think that it's also interesting that you think the Elric story is going to be a story about a group, but ends up just again being Elric doing his thing. I was very excited to be able to get the Elric of Melonbone story in there, and was able to talk to Linda Moorcock, Michael Moorcock's wife, and secure those rights. And there's a very interesting conversation we had about that, because I was originally thinking that I might try to see if I could secure the rights to some of the illustrations of where some of these stories appeared in the pulp magazines where they first appeared.
Science fantasy. And
science
yeah.
fantasy, exactly. Weird Tales. And so I found the science fantasy where that story first appeared. And I had mentioned to her that I might want to use, I said I might be illustrating the book and in that way. And she said, Michael wanted me to ask you to please not use that particular drawing of Elric, which is found in the original science fantasy pulp magazine, because he's sort of like, he doesn't look like the Elric that we have come to know from comics and even covers of the sort of more famous covers where he's sort of, you know, this sort of aquiline features, and he sort of looks, he's a little chunkier than you might expect Elric to be.
A little brawnier.
A
yeah.
little broader, you know,
yeah,
so
yeah.
there was even, you know, he wanted to make sure, even though, you know, when you read a story, you have your own ideas about this character, that he still felt that idea of Elric in the original pulp drawing was not quite right. And that was another thing that I want to say about working on a book like this, is interacting with the estates and even with some of the living authors of some of these stories. I wanted to tell you a little bit of a story about The Tower of Darkness by David Madison. So David Madison, that story is found in one of the Swords Against Darkness collection, which Gygax cites. And again, it's a weird thing where Gygax cites, I think, Gygax cites number 3 in the series, but why number 3? 1 through 4 contain amazing tales. So that was another place where I looked at all of those Swords Against Darkness anthologies and pulled out things again from authors that Gygax mentions, or from things that I felt really felt like that they were part of that thinking that shaped D&D. So Dave, the David Madison is, I found out that he wasn't alive anymore. And I did that sort of, you know, when you're Google searching and you get to the fifth or sixth page of your Google search and you've about to realize you're too far afield. But I did uncover an old blog post by this woman named Amanda. And I was able to find her on Facebook and I friended her and I asked her, I said, do you happen to know anything about David Madison? I'd love to be able to get in touch with his family or his estate to use this wonderful story. And she said, well, in fact, I am the owner of his estate. Be happy to give you permission. He actually committed suicide when he was, I think, 28 years old. And he was one of these young writers who were part of this really important fanzine, science fiction and fantasy fanzine scene of the mid to late 60s and 70s, where a lot of these authors got started. There would maybe be 50 to 100 copies of these zines. What's also amazing is that internet database has all those zines listed. Like, they did that level of research to compile that, website. But I was so honored to be able to have this, I think, tale that's in some ways lost now, unless you happen to have some of these old pulp magazines or have that version of Swords Against Darkness, for this young writer who was writing fantastic fantasy fiction and sad isn't around anymore. And so that was, again, one of the pleasures of putting together an anthology like this of stories that some of which I think people aren't even aware of.
I mean, I certainly hadn't read it before. That was one of the few in there that I was completely ignorant of going into it. And so, and yeah, it's a cool story. It's the vampire survival. Right?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
It's really a horror survival game.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
That's a very cool story. I wanted to ask as well a bit about the order you chose for this. Like, so, you know, I'm like a super pedantic historian type of person. And like, for me, I would have done them in chronological order. In a couple, because in part, I'd want to show what was post D&D.
Oh, and interesting. Really I think that's very clever.
By the time you get to 79, I mean, to me, 79 is D&D's already long in the tooth.
Yeah, maybe I should have done that. No.
I mean, having done Saini, for example, at the end, I mean, I thought was cool because before the comic was cool to kind of give you that kind of most primal vision of it. But, you know, as I was reading them, and I was always trying to draw the chains of influence, right?
Yes. Well, let me see if I can help you think with me why I, or bring you along with why I did them the way that I did. There was a couple of considerations. The first is there are three very long stories in here. The Tower of the Elephant, The Dreaming City by Michael Moorcock. Tower of Elephant is Robert E. Howard Conan's story. Dreaming City by Moorcock is the Elric story. And then The Black God's Kiss. Very long. And I wanted to make sure that those were not too closely paired in the way the book was laid out. So I decided to use those as the frame. Those long stories, so that the reading of it felt, you know, you were getting to these, building up to these sort of almost epic tales. And then I was trying to think again, so that changed my thinking. Instead of doing it either chronologically or alphabetically, to actually envision the book as a dungeon crawl. And so if you look at the book itself, we devised a map that is in the front and back, you know, that spreads out into a full map. And so the table of contents, it's a little contrived, I'll admit, but fun. The table of contents, each story corresponds to a room in the dungeon that you'd be exploring. So I decided, wouldn't it be fun to see, to navigate these stories as if you were playing a D&D module, which is also why at the beginning of the book, even before the introduction, there's a a sort of a little bit of a, as if this were a D&D module, how it might introduce you as the players. And then the table of contents, like I said, is supposed to be a key rather than a table of contents, a key to the dungeon itself.
Which is cool. And it's cool. Fun.
But yes, but probably yeah. not as rigorous historically as I think. And I really appreciate that because I do think hearing you say that there's something missing and not getting the feel for the later, the earliest tales like Dunsany to the later tales like David Madison's.
And, you know, I mean, after D&D came out, I mean, as I'm sure we're both aware, there were attempts to do fiction that was explicitly based on D&D, like Andre yes. Norton's, you know, Quag Keep, things
right.
like that. And so, you know, I mean, to me, it's kind of, I guess, because I study it so much, I think of the release of D&D as a seminal moment that unleashed all these creative forces in the world.
Exactly.
And, you know, that it's good to kind of tabulate what may have begun to just have that influence exerted on it, because certainly it turned out, I think, to have a profound influence
Absolutely.
On the way people yes. approached fantasy fiction.
Absolutely. And you start to see that in later editions of Dragon magazine, where the earlier stories were just more general fantasy fiction, right? But the later stories really seem to be trying to capture a D&D-like experience.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I think as well, I mean, thematically, I'm interested in the authors who knew each other, the things that were connected, any universes
yes.
that were shared and, you know, or because of Lovecraft, obviously. I mean, anytime we look at D&D and the collaborative authorship that kind of goes into creating stories, people draw parallels, people who do textual criticism academically, right, between that practice and the shared universe that is inhabited by a few of the authors you mentioned here, including Lovecraft, Clark Ashton Smith. And by the way, props for including Clark Ashton Smith.
Excellent.
I agree. That's one that should, you know, in which it is. I mean, I've heard people go out on a limb for Seven Geass's. It's like the key story.
Oh,
that,
interesting.
Like, you should
okay.
have, but
yep.
I mean, Empire of the Necromancers is just such a gritty, eerie, like you said, to speaking precisely to the sensibilities you're trying to evoke.
Yes.
That, you know, I have to approve of that. And of course, Howard as well.
That's
that
right.
Lovecraft, Ashton, Howard. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between them and the maybe, you know, the shared universe that Lovecraft probably was the first to start articulating around that?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, of course, people know Lovecraft sort of devised a kind of notion of the universe populated by these anti-deities, which we call the Cthulhu mythos, which had, you know, different, the elder gods and old ones. And he struck up early on, I think, a correspondence, I think first with Howard, if I'm right. And they had a very long friendship, which is seen in, you can see in these letters. And there was this idea that, you know, Howard might in fact have a story that kind of exists in tangent with the same world that the Cthulhu lives in, right? That these deities live in. And similarly, he would have a relationship like that with Clark Ashton Smith, who personally I think is the better of all three of them in terms of stylists, but we can have a different debate about that. So I do, for you listeners who haven't encountered Clark Ashton Smith, if you get this book and you like that story, I highly recommend seeking out other collections of his. And he too thought, you know, he could participate. And so they created sort of this shared thing, which I think it's not until then that we begin to call it the Cthulhu mythos, right? I don't think Lovecraft ever called his world the mythos until other authors started playing in that sandbox.
And maybe the sandboxes of D&D, the Forgotten Realms, or, you know, things like that that are so huge for Fifth Ed today are similarly kind of these collaborative sandboxes that we all participate in.
That's right. Yeah, I think so. But it is interesting to me, and I would really love to hear your thoughts about this, because I know it's a little bit controversial. So, you know, we're living in a time right now where D&D is incredibly popular. And and this was happening even pre-pandemic, right? I think the pandemic only really helped it. People now just bored at home wanting to try new things, right? And it really turns out you really can play D&D over Zoom. Not my favorite way of doing it, but it's definitely can be done. But even pre-pandemic, you had what was called the OSR, right? The old school renaissance. And again, for listeners who might not know what that is, this is a sort of movement that was trying to get role-playing games back to what was perceived as more improv, less rule, tightly, you know, codified rule sets. So the earliest versions of D&D, where they're slim little, right, pamphlets of rule books, right, that really requires the players and the DM to sort of collaboratively decide on the shape of a game or a world. So it feels more like, in some ways, even though the games themselves are can be very dungeon crawly, they still can almost feel more character or role-playing driven. Subsequent versions of D&D seem to, and this is where the controversy is, and you could argue right or wrong, and I'm really, John, I mean, you're the expert here, so I hope I'm not, you know, please correct me, but subsequent versions of D&D seem to put much more emphasis on the skills and prowess of the characters you created, to the point where it felt, I think for a lot of players, that you were playing more like a fantasy superhero than somebody like Conan, who was just trying to crawl through a dungeon, find the treasure, and make it out alive. And I think 5e has tried to get a little bit back to some of those general sensibility of D&D in the earlier days. But I still find what's interesting is how different D&D looks now. It does feel more, even though it might feel more like it can be a looser play, it feels even more like a contained universe than it did, at least when I played.
Yeah, it's certainly it's a broad question. We could do a whole hour just about this, I'm sure, if we wanted. But yeah, I mean, there was the distinction. And I mean, its roots are really in the distinction between the 1974 product, right, and the openness that, you know, everywhere through in it, Gygax and Arneson are appealing to us to don't let us do any more of your imagining for you, right? Go out and make what you want with this tool. No two D&D campaigns should be alike in their rules and their setting. This is really just a tool to unleash your creativity, to the point where, you know, early critics and thinking people like John Freeman, you know, would say that, you know, D&D was less a game than a design a game kit. Or maybe even less than that, you know, it's a system for designing a game system. And with AD&D, I think, is actually when it started, when in 1978, the Player's Handbook came out, and then subsequently the Dungeon Master's Guide, which contained the Appendix N we're here to talk about today. I mean, they were much more prescriptive. This was really a point where, for a variety of commercial and other political factors we don't need to go into here, they were trying to clamp down a bit on that original invitation. But to me, any version of D&D still contains that core possibility, right?
Yeah.
To have it your way. It's Burger King. Like, you know, this can be an artisanal experience that you and your friends agree upon around a table, or as the case may be now, a Zoom Brady Bunch display. And, you know, nobody other than the people participating need to like it or need to think
right,
it's cool.
Exactly.
You can always have it your way. And I don't think that 5e or even 3e really ever tried to prevent that, right?
Yes.
Certainly, when I was talking about modules earlier, modules are a great example of something that is, you know, an aid to the dungeon master, to the person running D&D, that provides them guidance on how to structure a particular adventure so you don't have to do the work of figuring out what should be in this room or procedurally generating it, as you point out, with like die rolls as you go. But those products have always been, you know, they're a huge part of D&D. They're very commercially successful. A lot of people play them, but it's certainly always been possible, and I think always will be possible with anything that's really D&D, right?
Yes.
For you to have it your way, just based on, hey, I read this cool story. I read Black God's Kiss, and I want to have this like dimension you go into, or there are these shadowy monsters that you're going to interface with, and there's a quest, and you know, we're just going to run it the way that I think that story could have gone with a group of people going into
right.
it. That's always
yes.
been the virtue of D&D.
Yes.
It's always been its magic.
Yes. There does seem to be, and I appreciate that, and I think people feel too beholden to the rules when you still don't have to be. There's no grand rules lawyer except for an individual at the table, right? But there does seem to be a aesthetic homogeneity that you didn't see in the earlier versions of D&D. And I think that's mainly because maybe it just had to do with it being sort of smaller press and not being able to hire in the way. And I don't know. I mean, maybe you could talk to that. Why do you think, and that was part of what I was trying to do with Appendix N. And I think seeing that in Guy Gax's own list is how different some of these tales are from each other, and it feeling like D&D itself, when you would open up even that Dungeon Master's Guide, all the different artwork styles, some very low,
amateurish,
some very beautifully done. But it almost seems that current D&D is all painted with the same brush. And I'm curious as to why you think that's happened over the iterations of the game.
I mean, I certainly think you're correct that as it became a business and not just a hobby, right? Because when they published D&D originally, it was still like basically a hobby to Guy Gax and Arneson and their friends that work with them on this. And yeah, by the 80s, they could afford the Larry Elmores, the Jeff Easleys, like people who would be able to provide a quality of art that was unimaginable when they started out. I mean, I worked on this book that came out a couple of years ago called Art and Arcana, which actually kind of traces, you know, the earliest art. And I wrote a lot of the 70s part of that, obviously, myself. And I mean, yeah, these were local kids who could draw a little bit that would work basically for free, $2 or $3 a picture.
It was like a punk rock fanzine. I like to connect. I like to make that connection for myself. It felt that way. Even when I first discovered the game, I felt like the underground quality of it was very attractive.
It's extremely compelling to me, obviously, yeah, because it shows that you can get by and get the idea across and get people's imaginations fired up with the simplest things. It's kind of like retro 8-bit gaming where you invest, you know, all of the actual graphics, like, you know, they come out of your mind, and you kind of impose them on these games that you play. But yeah, certainly to your point, like by the time you get to fifth edition, and, you know, Wizards of the Coast obviously is now owned by Hasbro. And I mean, they have considerable resources and staff, and they have codes and practices.
That's right. They have a style guide, right?
They have a style guide. That will lead to some homogeneity in terms of how these things are visually presented. And there's also just much more scrutiny of the rules themselves. Certainly since the internet, since you can just, you know, tweet at somebody at Wizards, right, and get responses on rules clarifications and things like it. Yeah, there's a much higher expectation that the system be consistent, that it be exhaustive, that it cover all the things you might want to try to do. And that just wasn't the case, right, back in the day.
Right.
The kinds of structures you need to support that, they're necessarily going to make the game world feel more homogenous. And
yeah,
I think as well, the choice in fifth edition to predicate things on the Forgotten Realms, in particular on Ed Greenwood's creation, even taking classic things like the Tomb of Horrors or things we would associate with Greyhawk back in the 1970s and relocating them, transplanting them into the Forgotten Realms in different places. I mean, that certainly makes that even more pronounced.
Well, because I mean, it's partly the power of that power of something like the Marvel universe, right? And you could tell all kinds of different stories within that. You can have the TV shows that never mention the movies necessarily, like the Netflix Daredevil, but we know that they all exist in this shared place. And there's something very both comforting and exciting about, you know, when you start to get into the lore, right, and making those connections. So I think that that's also how a lot of properties take on that element, right? I wanted to ask you, of the books and authors mentioned in Guy Gax's Appendix N, what are some of your standouts? What do you sort of love from his list?
Good question. I mean, so I was reading Elric and things like that when I grew up. It frankly wasn't until I started studying D&D that I became familiar with people like Fritz Leiber, for example. And, you know, I find, you know, the core authors that Guy Gax initially identified, which includes, you know, DeCamp and Pratt, for example. I couldn't get
the rights to those. Yeah, I wanted them. So again, I do want to say for listeners who might say, why wasn't this author story in there? It was probably because I couldn't get the rights.
Well, that makes sense.
Like Fox Gardner, I couldn't get the rights.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting. Now, and there is some good stuff in that. I mean, to me, I really go back to, yeah, Moorcock, to Anderson, to DeCamp and Pratt. You know, the Edgar Rice Burroughs angle is one that I get it inspirationally why that's there, but isn't as direct a hit for me as some of the others.
Yes.
Obviously, you know, I think the influence of Tolkien on all of this is downplayed to a degree that is almost cynical in the way that Gygax presents it.
Well, he does downplay, so we didn't get to talk about that. We had mentioned that earlier on. I mean, there is a Dragon article in one of the early issues where Gygax seems to go out of his way to say the elements of play that I was conceiving are not influenced by Tolkien. That Gandalf is not a wizard that you could play in D&D.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's certainly true. You know, at the same time, I think there's four references to Tolkien in the first printing of D&D, right? I mean, it's a description of like orcs, his description of the rock, you know, the eagles from Tolkien, specters, there's one more, wights maybe. But, you know, I mean, so I don't think he ever managed to sweep it under the rug. From my own reading of his articles about this, and he wrote quite early on outside of the Dragon about kind of fantasy wargaming, the influence of J.R.R. Tolkien in particular. There's a famous article about that he did. You know, I think he was mostly concerned that it had become a standard. It becomes such an expectation on the part of readers that your description of, for example, a troll can form with what Tolkien presents a troll to be. And he didn't want to be boxed in by that. He wanted his troll to be able to be the true troll, the regenerating troll from, you know, Paul Anderson's Three Hearts and Three Lions.
Right.
And by the way, your Anderson choice, I thought it was great.
I'm not sure I've actually read that story before. Oh, I love it so much.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd read that one before. I'm obviously pretty familiar with his
called
novels.
Tales of Hawk, which I think is more, is while it's not mentioned, it is one of the sort of Viking, part of that Viking thing that Gygax does mention in the book. What's the, I lost the name of the book that Anderson wrote, which is sort of his Viking.
Broken Sword?
Broken Sword, yes, thank you. Yes. So that doesn't appear there, but it's of that sensibility. But I think it's a very wonderful tale, and also feels in some ways very much like a D&D adventure. A single person, but in terms of the encounter and there being almost these rules around different, what he can wear to the fight, what works and what doesn't, you know, and you grab, I even wanted to call out rules for grappling up here, sort of in that story. So I hope when your readers find that, for the readers that find that for the first time are also enjoy it. It's a wonderful tale.
Yeah, stylistically also, it shows Anderson at his peak, I think.
Yes.
I mean, I think the way that he, you know, melds in these kind of Viking era concepts and vocabulary and his presentation of it is really exemplary. And it's a cool, creepy story.
It really is. And I found it in A Swords Against Darkness. So again, it's still part of those works that appear in the Appendix N.
Yeah, I mean, so I I'm sure you know, Tolkien, there's nothing bite-sized you could have put it in, even if the rights were available. It's because that stuff is all this just so huge. I mean, there aren't really a lot of short stories you could break off from it. I mean, what else would you have loved to be able to include that you couldn't manage to get in?
Yeah, I'll tell you. So I really wanted a Fox Gardner tale of his Here's Barbarian, just the name again.
Kothar
the Barbarian, yeah. That would have been a lot of fun. Here's the one that I was close to doing for the one excerpt other than the Song of Swords, which is a poem that appears in the Book of Swords by Saberhagen. That felt to me actually like a very D&D thing that works on its own, even though it really is sort of an excerpt. But the only other excerpt I really wanted was going to be very expensive, it turned out, was I wanted a scene from The Once and Future King, which is personally one of my favorite, not only favorite fantasy novels, but favorite novels. It is absolutely the antidote to cynicism. If you need that in your life, I recommend The Once and Future King. And there is a scene in there where the young Arthur and his companion discover essentially Robin Hood, a sort of Robin Hood pastiche and Maid Marian, and they have to go and find a witch's house. And it is a perfect description of rangering in D&D. And it's a wonderful part of the novel, but there's these very specific descriptions of Marion teaching Arthur how to be a ranger in the woods and how to track something and how to be quiet, and how to use stealth in the bow. It's a wonderful moment. And I was able to get in touch with the estate, but the amount of money they wanted, you know, for that excerpt was just impossible.
That's too bad. That would have been pretty cool. Yeah.
And the Pratt stuff I wanted, you know, there were just folks that either weren't responsive, or with the Fox Gardner, they didn't want to provide the rights because they are in the process of putting together their own anthology of his tales. So they didn't want it to ride on. But then there were some surprises. The people that managed the Conan estate, the easiest rights acquiring I had to do. Cheap, very kind, excited, supportive. I thought that was going to be a headache trying to get rights to a Conan story, but it was, they were very, very generous and very, like I said, very excited about the project as well. So
I mean, I was very interested to see that you included just a little bit of comics. And in fact, I may have read a hint in your introduction that if there were to be a sequel to this book, perhaps you could do something. And I think that would be a very interesting project. So kind of where do you see the comics angle on this? Because obviously comics exerted an enormous influence.
Yeah, it was an enormous influence. And then I think, like we said, would become something that would start to reveal the influence of D&D, right, on the culture. And so I see an Appendix N, like an Appendix N squared, and that was sort of a tease to it. Something that would include some of the early World's Best Fantasy collections post D&D, or around the time, you know, the early 80s when we're starting to see that stuff, that was, you know, that it could have been something that came out a year after the Dungeon Master's Guide was published. And so Gygax just didn't have access to it, right? There's a bunch of wonderful tales and excerpts from comics and things that I think could be a fun, very much my Appendix N of the Appendix N as an idea.
But I mean, so much of it comes over directly. I mean, obviously there was the Roy Thomas Conan books. I mean, rights for those might be difficult to secure at this point.
Yes, but there's some great stories from Creepy and Eerie that were part of that. And again, some of these, the comic that's in there first appeared and actually in a fanzine. So there's still that ongoing fanzine culture that at the time that, you know, could provide some really wonderful tales that are likely both cross-influencing.
Yeah, I remember even in Season of the Witch, I think you alluded to Creepy and Eerie and things like that at one point. Again, just giving people the broader context of this. And I think it is. It's impossible to look at any of these things in isolation. The web of influences that surround them, that kind of culturally influence them at the time, is so immense. I'm sure you could do a whole music based sequence.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Where's the album version? Yes.
And it would be very interesting. And I would love to know if you've thought about this. And I know how much would, you know, maybe we could end on this, but how much do you feel that, talking about context, that Dungeons and Dragons is a product of the 1970s, that it couldn't have happened in another decade?
I mean, there's a number of reasons why that's true. Yes. I mean, the popularity of Tolkien, I think, was essential to it. And it really wasn't until Tolkien had reached, you know, where it's now a number one bestseller on the New York Times list, that most improbable thing that could have happened.
That's right.
But, you know, it was the cultural forces of the 60s. And you talk about this a lot, too, the idealism, the medievalism, agrarianism, you know, that helped popularize it. It was an attention.
Yeah, society for creative anachronism, right?
Certainly. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, all those things coming together. And you also, to the SCA, you can't understate the degree to which the protagonists in the SCA were early adopters of D&D, especially in the Bay Area, and helped define the reception of the game and steer it in directions that maybe the folks in Lake Geneva wouldn't have intended.
Right, because they were still thinking about wargamers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I think they're totally agreed. I mean, you need a bit of that 60s idealism, and you need its crash. You need Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So much you see like a drive towards fantasy wargaming and kind of fantastic conceptions, especially the, unfortunately, the sort of reductive good versus evil that was so lacking in the way that people looked at the American intervention in Vietnam, right? That escapist fantasy, I think, was absolutely essential to the reception of D&D and related things. And we are getting to it. We are getting to the hour. I feel like we could do an entire other hour on this, Peter. Really, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank
you. I tremendously enjoyed the book. Highly recommend it. It comes out soon?
February 21st is the pub date for the paperback.
I don't know when this podcast will air, but probably around that time, I imagine it will be forthcoming. It is pre-orderable, I assume. And there's a deluxe edition as well.
I think it's completely sold out.
Oh, yeah. I see.
But the timing is nice because you also have a book coming out about D&D culture.
I have a couple. Yeah, I just did a book called The Elusive Shift that came out in December of 2020. That is
with MIT Press.
With MIT Press, yeah. That is about kind of how people made sense of what it could mean for something to be a role-playing game. Once D&D was unleashed, how the role-playing game genre got constructed by the earliest adopters, including a lot of those folks were in the SCA. That is out. You can get that now if you want. I guess I should be plugging it
We're
doing this on MIT.
Absolutely.
Well, seriously, Peter, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank
and
you.
We should talk. We should talk more.
Oh, yeah.
Talk offline.
Yeah, please.
Please, let's do that.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thanks again. And
thank you.
I guess with that, we will be done for today.
Thank you for listening to the MIT Press Podcast. And thank you to John and Peter for that wonderful discussion. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast if you don't want to miss future episodes. And if you can, head over to iTunes to give us a 5-star review. Finally, thank you to Samantha Doyle, who mixes and edits the podcast, and Kristen Galineau, who produced the soundtrack.